perfume is the message. Money makes a dance. Love is the product. The joke is in. The joke is in. The joke is in your face.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show. Can you pass the acid test? Can you suit up, put on your helmet, and run a military mission on 180 micrograms? Today, our guest is James Ketchum, author of Chemical Warfare, Secrets Almost Forgotten, a book about his work with chemicals like LSD and BZ for the United States military during the 1960s. But before we go there, we've got Jeff Deal, we've got Steve Robles, and we've got Destiny with something to talk about.
That's right. I've got a very special topic. Let's talk about sex, or at least sex drugs. Medicare will purchase erectile dysfunction medication for men over the age of 65. But in a few days, that's going to stop. It's an expensive drug. It's one of the most.
And that's not the only thing that's going to stop.
Point taken. It's not going to be a very happy New Year for some people out there. those bean counters in Washington D.C.
No happy ending to this year.
Yeah. I'd love to see a picture of that, or maybe I wouldn't. You've got people in Washington D.C. They count all the beans and they go, "Okay, here's all the medications that we have. Then, and we've got to cut costs somehow. Oh, this one costs hundreds of bucks. Well, what is it? Viagra. Well, Viagra. I don't know. Do we or don't we cover that? So the thing is, the feds won't cover. Your taxpayer dollars will not pay for the erectile dysfunction drugs anymore. Now, the health plans have the option of saying, well, we'll cover them, or your employer has the option of kicking in. But that's where we're at now. It's not an automatically covered drug via Medicare. And if you're a senior citizen and you're on a health plan and they say, oh, I got some bad news for you about 2007, Grandpa, then, you know, I would probably be shopping for another one.
And let me
he may not get to be a grandpa.
Yeah, those drugs ain't cheap either.
Yeah, I got an email just the other day about Viagra.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that
I got several, as a matter of fact.
Drugs ain't cheap.
And
some reason why I haven't seen you out lately.
Yeah.
So the underground market is going to
explode,
absolutely,
so to speak.
It's going to rise up, and then there'll be many happy endings.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thought, though. You get all these seniors who are used to this new lifestyle, and what are they going to? How are they going to react?
They're
when
all
taken away from them.
They're going to get into a fucking van, and this already happens with other medications. They get into a fucking van and drive down to Mexico, where things are, you know,
well, that's
the land of plenty.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say they're going to get into a van and like drive into the White House or something like that with explosives.
I think, wouldn't
angry,
you?
Angry,
you know?
Seniors without their Viagra.
Maybe they'll just drive to 7-Eleven and buy porn. I mean, or they could drive to Canada, too, is the other thing. It's also cheaper there.
Well, I've heard that the older women, though, are really kind of...
not happy.
Yeah, no, not because of the possible absence of Viagra, but over Viagra itself, that they've gotten their guys all jacked up, and then, you know, these...
Who wants
dried
it?
Out old vaginas can't handle all the action.
We're here with James Ketchum, author of Chemical Warfare, Secrets Almost Forgotten, from 1961 to 1971. Dr. Ketchum was at the Center of U.S. Military Research into BZ and LSD and other interesting chemicals as potential incapacitating chemical warfare agents. Ketchum, a psychiatrist, has also published about incapacitating agents in the 1999 textbook of military medicine assembled by the Office of the Surgeon General, and he later maintained a private practice as a psychiatrist and taught, I'm sure you talked as well, at UCLA. And welcome, James.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show. So I set the scene for the research that you did at Edgewood Arsenal with various substances as weapons. And in other words, not just your own the beginning of your own career there, but the political environment and so forth.
Well, it was during the Cold War, and most people are not familiar with that personally anymore, but a great concern at that time about the Soviet Union and what they might be plotting. It was known that they were investing a lot of money in chemical warfare research, about 10 times as much as we were. And at the same time, there was an interest in developing weapons that might be called humane, as opposed to conventional weapons, or more humane. And surprisingly, in 1955, Congress was entertained by Major General Creasy, who described what LSD could do. That was, at the time, the latest drug of interest. And as he described it to Congress, they became very enthusiastic and voted in favor of doing research with LSD as a possible incapacitating agent that would be life-sparing, and passed a resolution with only one vote against it, which is indicative of the philosophy of the times, perhaps. So money was allocated to build a project at Edgewood Arsenal, the Army Chemical Center. And over the next few years, the budgeting increased, supported by John F. Kennedy, for example. And I was given the opportunity to go there after my residency in psychiatry in 1961, and I thought that would be interesting. And I ended up spending about 10 years there. The program, when I arrived, was just in its nascency. There had been some work done with LSD by others there, but they had never had a psychiatrist and had run into a few problems, which made them think they ought to have one. So I was given pretty much of a free hand over the next few years to kind of develop a program that would be safe and also provide the information that was being sought on not only LSD, but drugs like BZ and others. And that's what I did.
And so you actually ended up having a long, strange trip of your own there. You had some very interesting experiences with it.
It was a road less traveled, I guess, and I enjoyed it very much. But unfortunately, at the time, classification of that research was so great that very little of the information that we found was leaked out to the public or allowed to be spread among the public. And as is the custom in the Army, or was the custom, classified papers usually remain classified for 12 years before they'd be downgraded and made available. So by that time, most people had gone separate ways. The program itself had been pretty much terminated, and no one really wrote the history of that decade, which I thought later was a serious omission, and that's what led to my writing this book.
Do you know of any evidence that the Soviets might have taken this tack in their own chemical warfare research?
Well, there was information indicating that the Soviet Union around 1960 was importing vast quantities of fermented rye from the satellite countries. And this was interpreted as being indicative of their interest in producing LSD, since not much use for fermented rye, except that it contains ergot, which is a form of contamination. And that made us think maybe they were having a big LSD development program of their own.
So there was a different kind of space race going on at the same time.
That's right, inner space.
Yeah.
The meat of this book, and really the fun part of it, is in the descriptions of the people undergoing the experiments. And I wonder if any particular ones pop into your head as in terms of just the way that the human beings behave under the influence.
Well, yeah, I watched a number of people, actually more than 100, going through the experience of having BZ, which is a long-acting atropine-type compound, not much different in its properties, incidentally, but it produces delirium if given in a sufficient dose, a half a milligram being sufficient in the case of BZ as compared with, say, 10 milligrams of atropine. And to describe the trip in detail would take some time. I've documented in full in the book here an entire BZ trip over 100-hour period, including everything that was said and done. And people
like you had a man watching an entire like football game on his fingernail or something.
A baseball game on the padded floor, really.
Right.
But the hallucinations were real hallucinations, and I like to make a distinction between BZ hallucinations and LSD so-called hallucinations, which are really not hallucinations. They're more illusions. People generally know that they're not real, but produced by the drug, whereas with BZ, the individual becomes delirious and in that state is unable to distinguish fantasy from reality and may see strips of bacon along the edge of the floor.
Few people may have experience with belladonna, which would be the most common deliriant.
Loco weed. Right. Belladonna in the form of Asmodor, for example, which was used for asthma and contains atropine. And people were getting high on this in the 60s. My brother described one young man trying to crawl across a street in New York City and grabbing onto the pants leg of a police officer. People don't know what they're doing when they're under the influence. They mistake people for objects and objects for people. They'll salute the water fountain or bump into a nurse and say, "Excuse me, sir," and the like. So it becomes rather... they also do things like smoke imaginary cigarettes and go through the motion of holding.
So are you guys doing a lot of chuckling while this is going on? You're trying to maintain a certain
decorum.
Degree of decorum. But
yes, I would tell the technicians before we were able to get professional nurses that... it wasn't nice to laugh at these things, even though the subject probably wouldn't remember it later. And it was sometimes kind of hard to suppress when one individual asked another in the same padded room if he could have a cigarette. And when the first individual held out an empty hand that looked like it was holding a pack, he said, oh, I don't want to take your last one. So this was a folie à deux on a rather fantastic scale.
I actually have a friend who took belladonna at a rock and roll concert.
Oh.
And about halfway into it, he thought he was back in his own room and that the music on the radio really sucked and he was going to turn it off, which involved basically twisting this girl's kneecap for a while until he got... fortunately, it was the kneecap.
But, right. One young man tried to straighten out my arm as if it were a pipe of some sort, and he tugged on it and pulled it and didn't seem at all aware that I might be discomforted by that.
Here's a segment of a report on somebody under the influence of BZ. Smokes imaginary cigarette, talks to imaginary people while standing, looking at wall, grabs nurses' caps while she was sitting on stool, twisted stethoscope around her neck. Oh, I thought you were a truck driver. Walked over to window. I hope they don't lock this damn door. Hey, a pack of cigarettes, if you read Mexican. Then a little while later, interview with Dr. Ketchum. Subject tried to move table. Walks over to wall, tries to climb wall. Hey, come over here on the double. Hey, Jank, over here. I couldn't get in there to get my suit. See, you know what happened? Walked to where Dr. K was interviewing another subject, seemed to be tired. Seems about to go to sleep standing up. Sat on Dr. Ketchum lightly. Got up, went back to the window. Hey, me too. I'm glad you don't want to cause... I don't either. Hold on to your bacon. Trying to climb wall. That's 2 hours and 50 minutes, isn't it, sir? Sit on the bottles and paint it green. Dr. Ketchum says, come over here, I want to interview. Subject stood on bed, stared at wall, sat down on chair, shuffled cards for some time. Dr. K, sort cards in four different suits. Started sorting in four different piles, but not in four different suits. This is what I'm afraid of. And then attention spans short. Talk to wall, quote, hey, why didn't you get canned for that? Well, put that in your spipe, into your pipe and smoke it. Hey, I'd like to fuck that. hey, 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 holy mackerel, Andy, etc. So this book, which is about a very serious subject, is actually quite an amusing read.
Yeah, I tried to keep it from being too heavy and included a number of anecdotes of people who weren't delirious, which were equally funny, I think.
Yeah, some of the inter-office activity was amusing as well. Describe what happened to soldiers who tried to deal with sort of mock-up battle conditions under the influence of LSD.
Well, of course, commanders wanted to know what would happen if this stuff were ever used in the field, so we set up at first an indoor type of situation, a sort of simulated command post with four soldiers in it, one of whom was given a full dose of BZ, the others were given either small or none at all in order to have some possibility of maintaining order. And the one individual would continually go to the door and try to get out and then turn around and say, I'll see you later, but it was locked. And he finally concluded that he was trapped. And when the cameras, which were behind these sliding plywood doors, were open, he came over to one and looked into it as if with the eye of a Martian, I guess. And he tried to climb out through the medicine cabinet, and then he went over to the water bag and yelled, hey, this broad just committed suicide. It took quite a bit of help from his teammates there to keep him from hurting himself, but fortunately nothing serious happened.
Now, you say that nobody was really injured or permanently damaged by these experiments, and you make a distinction between the work that you did at the arsenal and work done by the Central Intelligence Agency. And we'll talk about the differences between those programs.
I tried to dissect out the work done by the Army from the work done by the CIA. The CIA, of course, was the first to undertake studies with LSD. They had no real scientific structure to do it with, and they took liberties that they shouldn't have taken, giving it covertly to American citizens and the like. And this was called MK Ultra program. Unfortunately, Edgewood Arsenal acquired a reputation for being somehow involved in the MK Ultra program, being somehow underwritten by the CIA, and this was not true. There were a couple of individuals who had a secret connection with the CIA, but the program itself was transparent, you might say, to at least within the military, and there was none of the hijinks that the CIA carried out in San Francisco, for example, and other places.
And you actually recently gave testimony about the CIA program.
Yes, I did.
Tell us a little about that.
I testified on behalf of a deputy U.S. Marshal who had been an ideal officer, 4 years in the Marines, a year at Alcatraz as a guard. He was regarded as perfectly stable, normal. And after a Christmas party where people from the CIA next door were present, he came back to the office to take over for the last hour and began to believe that everyone was against him, and went out on the street and walked home for the first time without his car, and was then convinced that his girlfriend was against him, that the bartender was against him, and decided to hold up a bar and get enough money for his girlfriend to fly to New York, and then he'd be arrested, and they would put him out of the marshals, and everyone would be happy. So this is what he did, and this is what happened. And when he came to and realized what he'd done, he felt terrible. He wanted to commit suicide. He asked for a bullet to save the state some money. He submitted a letter of resignation. And from that point on, he was regarded as a pariah and spent the rest of his life believing he had committed a serious crime for which he could never be forgiven. until finally Sidney Gottlieb, who was the head of the MK Ultra program, died, and in his obituary to mention that he was supervising the administration of LSD to unwitting American citizens, and so the light went on at that point, and Wayne realized or believed that that's probably what happened to him. So a case was eventually brought to court, and I was asked to testify on behalf of Wayne, and spent 2.5 days on the witness stand, most of it answering questions from CIA lawyers. Ultimately, the outcome was not favorable, unfortunately, but the judge didn't feel convinced, and neither did the appeals court, so it was a rather unhappy ending to an unhappy story.
I had heard it was actually kind of a mixed ruling, right? The judge never ruled out the possibility that this could have actually occurred, but he was just a little bit shy of utterly convinced of it.
Well, it was a she. But anyway, yes, she didn't rule it out, but she said, in effect, if you can explain this man's criminal behavior with LSD on LSD, then I suppose you could blame anyone's criminal behavior on LSD. And this really wasn't very logical and didn't fit the facts, but that's how it ended up.
Let's break for a couple of minutes and listen to some chemically induced music, and we'll be right back.
Don't need Yeah, that was straight into 6 o'clock. I mean,
so what are we going to do now?
Hold up. We're going to take a little detour into some other shit.
We'd like to introduce you now to a group with its very first hit in the charts. Now, fellas, this disc of yours makes great use of the technique. What do you do about it on stage?
Oh, it's done with a couple of tape recorders. You know, I've got two big tape recorders on stage.
Yeah. So you play one track and there's one already there. Is that what you mean?
That's right, yeah.
Great.
Do you regard your music as a political statement as well as a musical statement?
Well, I mean, I don't see how you can separate the two, really. I mean, any kind of action whatsoever these days is... I don't see how you can separate from politics. I mean, going to buy a loaf of bread is in some ways associated with politics because, you know, the price of that loaf of bread is defined by politics.
Okay, fine. Well, we won't go into that. Let's instead hear the number.
Are you serious?
We're back with James Ketchum, author of Chemical Warfare, Secrets Almost Forgotten. And a fascinating read indeed. Psychedelic enthusiasts won't necessarily find the reports in this book that far removed from their own interests. And a number of the volunteers expressed feelings of having had a profound experience and more frequently than not sort of a regret in coming down and having the experience end.
Yes, we were primarily interested in measuring performance on a systematic basis, but of course clinically it was pretty hard to ignore the differences in the response to LSD that we observed. Individuals would either become very frolicsome and laugh a great deal, or they might become depressed and withdrawn. Some of them became paranoid, and seeing the spectrum of responses in otherwise normal young men was quite interesting. One individual in particular actually had a therapeutic experience, I believe, when he was in a group of four, and we held a televised discussion after the test, and he admitted finally, under pressure from his buddies, that he had had some unacceptable erotic thoughts about the nurses, which he was reluctant to reveal, and they told him that was all right, and nothing wrong with that. And when he went back to his unit, I heard indirectly that his personality was different. He became more sociable and outgoing, and I had to give LSD some of the credit in that case.
There were also a frequent response from some of the volunteers was to find the tests and so forth to just silly and absurd and to just sort of laugh at the things that they were asked to do.
Yeah, under LSD, they perceived the absurdity of being asked to solve as many arithmetic problems as they could in 3 minutes, and sometimes refused to do it altogether. But in other cases, they did their best, but couldn't do as well as they did before the drug. And I took it once and had the precisely same difficulty solving arithmetic problems, but I didn't have any of the wonderful visions and fantasies, I guess, because I was thinking of the psychopharmacology of the LSD going through my RAFA nucleus, et cetera, et cetera.
And now, you took, as I remember, 80 micrograms, a little bit shy of a trip.
Yeah, but it was chemically pure U.S. Army grade, 99.9%.
Got any of that stuff left?
Well, there was 40 pounds left in my office one day in a big black barrel.
Oh, yes. Do tell the story of the canister.
Yeah, I was chief of the department at that point, and I noticed when I came into work one day, there was a big black sort of oil barrel type drum in the corner of the room, and no one said anything or told me anything about it. So after a couple of days, my curiosity overcame me, and I opened it up after everyone had gone home and pulled out a jar and looked and saw that it was about 3.41623 pounds of or kilograms of LSD, and so were the rest of the jars.
Drop that baby on her ass.
In what form?
It was in the form of the tartrate or the maleate. I'm not sure, or the freebase. There were three different forms that we studied, but after another couple of days, the barrel was gone. I never heard anything. I never got a receipt for it. It was probably about $1 billion worth of LSD on the street there, and it just stayed there for a few days and went away.
Speaking of getting on the street, I've never heard of BZ, and I imagine the reason why is because it didn't penetrate the black market?
No, it's really not the sort of thing people would tend to want to take. Yeah. But describe it a little bit.
Well, it's, as I say, similar to atropine or belladonna, which some people have taken for trips and been used through the ages for ceremonial purposes, for various purposes.
I remember Dirk Pearson saying that it was interesting.
But, yeah. It lasts about 72 hours in a dose that is just sufficient to incapacitate someone. Longer if you take more, but we kept the doses as low as we could. Delirium is not something that anyone particularly wants to go through. It's more of a shipment than a trip, I would say. And when you come out of it...
you don't really remember much.
You don't remember much. And
it's probably more fun to watch other people.
Yeah, not much to cull from it, doesn't sound like.
Right. Not too much intelligent insight emerges under its effects.
Let's get back a little bit to the purpose of this research and what you're hoping that it would be able to do to perhaps an enemy soldiers or that sort of thing.
Well, I felt I was working in a noble cause because the purpose of this research was to find something that would be an alternative to bombs and bullets, and it could also be helpful in reducing civilian casualties, which have increased ever since the Civil War from almost 0% to about 80% now, and or maybe higher, 90% perhaps in Iraq, because you can't really avoid collateral damage if the enemy is going to hide among the civilians. And I believe that it's perhaps a good time to rethink our use of incapacitating agents as a humane alternative. The Russians were very good at doing this when the Chechen terrorists took over an auditorium filled with attendees at a Moscow concert and held them captive for 3 days. And the Russians brought in an incapacitating agent, happened to be a morphine derivative of high potency, and pumped it in through the ceiling and through the floor, waited for a while, and then rushed in. And these terrorists did not detonate the bombs they were having strapped to their bodies. They did not fire their weapons. They were all down on the floor unconscious, as was most of the audience. And they were able to save about 80% of the audience.
You feel that maybe they could have used a better incapacitating agent that would have allowed them to save everybody or nearly everybody?
No, I don't think there was anything better that could have been used. This was a quick-acting drug, which it had to be. If we used BZ or if they'd used BZ or some drug like that, right, the effects would come on too gradually. The terrorists would have time to figure out what was going on. Right. So this was a knockout effect, and it worked very well. And I credit the Russians for doing this, although they seem to be embarrassed about giving out the details, because in the United States and Western world in general, chemical warfare in any form is a no-no.
But it's illegal internationally, isn't it?
A number of treaties drawn up, the last of which was the Chemical Warfare Convention. And it's now illegal to use any drug that can either cause death or seriously disturb behavior. And it's unfortunate that we went in and agreed to this treaty, I think, because we're now in a different kind of war from anything we've been in previously.
I wonder what the effect would be on people who are that take their principles to heart versus, I think, a soldier is kind of indoctrinated into a kind of belief very superficially, whereas the kind of thing that we're dealing with in Iraq is, you know, these people are very serious and they take their beliefs very seriously. I wonder what kind of effect LSD would have in either dislodging that or maybe even reinforcing it. Not LSD, but any kind of mind-altering chemical.
You mean on our soldiers?
Oh, no, on
the opposition.
Yeah. fanatical Islamists, mainly speaking.
Well, I think there's a distinction to be made between psychedelics that might make them see God and become all the more religious, and these incapacitating agents that are just going to...
Well, LSD was discarded pretty early when it was realized that it could produce highly unpredictable effects and that people could still retain the ability to fire a rifle or push a button on a bomb release mechanism. So LSD would not be used, I'm pretty sure. It would have to be something in the opiate category, such as was used in Moscow, or perhaps one of the rapid-acting belladonna-like drugs, which incidentally, although BZ was adopted briefly and even packed into munitions, was never used, as far as I know, despite rumors to the contrary. But later on, we found rapid-acting compounds in the same category, short-acting rapid compounds, which would have been much better. But by this time, I think the whole notion of militarizing incapacitating agents had passed its window of opportunity, and that's one reason that all this research really kind of was left in file cabinets.
Now, we've talked about the psychedelics, and we've talked about delirients. What about disassociatives like ketamine and PCP? Do those hold any potential in your opinion, and do you know if that was looked into at all?
A little work was done with PCP before my arrival. They had a complication in one individual who became psychotic and required hospitalization, and this kind of scared them. In fact, that's one reason I was asked to go there. So PCP would probably not be an acceptable drug.
That's not an uncommon reaction to PCP, right? Violence.
PCP definitely.
It definitely can produce aggressive behavior and resistant behavior that's very hard to overcome.
Talk about during the 1970s, it was a time of a great revelation of government crimes and alleged government crimes, and Edgewood Air Force, and your work got sort of roped into the general attitude in the media towards the establishment, towards the military, and so forth. Talk a little bit about how you feel the media misinterpreted your work.
Well, that grew out of the congressional hearings, the most famous of which was the Kennedy hearings. And the CIA was investigated, and an attempt was made to find out just what they did with LSD back then in the early 50s. They had destroyed all their records, and the people who were still around claimed they couldn't remember anything. But as a result of that, the Army was asked to look at its work with similar agents, and the Inspector General held a very comprehensive review. National Academy of Sciences was asked to do a review of the work with BZ, and although they produced negative follow-up findings of harm, somehow in the public mind, the CIA and the U.S. Army became interwoven, and that's an unfortunate thing, I believe.
Now, you also, I think, say that my friend Martin Lee, who wrote the book Acid Dreams, got a few things wrong in there.
I mentioned that to you while you were helping me write this book. RU was an editor who worked with me on part of this. I said that without having a specific item in mind. I think it was probably in relation to their characterization of BZ as a super hallucinogen, which really is not a good way to describe it. It's a deliriant, really, basically, pure
right.
and simple.
Okay. Now, let's move into, before we let you go, let's move into current times. And you've indicated that some of today's potential bioweapons, the effects of some of these might be a little bit exaggerated in the media. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the bioweapons are a different story, if you're using the word...
Or chemical weapons,
chemical
possibly,
weapons.
Yeah.
What was the question again?
That some of the claims about some of the possible effects of some of these weapons have been distorted and exaggerated in the media?
In terms of being causing
the potency,
problems.
Yeah, for instance, of VX, I think you've spoken to.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. This is in relation to nerve agents, which I really wasn't an expert on. Well, that work was going on next door, but people have been told that a couple of drops of VX on the floor of Macy's would wipe out the entire customer population, and things of that type have been represented in programs like 24, which I think is a great series. But people have a morbid fear of anything chemical, it appears, and it's been encouraged by the media, and not too many accurate facts have been brought out. As a matter of fact, nerve agents are a good antidote for drugs like BZ, ironically, and vice versa. Atropine's used to treat nerve agent poisoning, and nerve agents can be used to treat atropine or BZ poisoning. We found this out in the lab. Of course, anyone who heard that they were going to be treated with a nerve agent for their atropine or BZ poisoning would probably be very unhappy.
Be nervous.
Very nervous. But it works very well.
So tell people how they can get a hold of this book. It's an independent publication. It's a unique, almost like a coffee table.
I thought you were going to say tell people how they can get a hold of that black barrel.
Yeah, where did you hide that black barrel?
Well, the book is in a very early stage of publication. I've never written a book before, and so I have had it printed privately, and I'm just beginning to distribute it. I'm trying to make a website, which is going to be called ForgottenSecrets.net, but I can't seem to get a password to get it on the net yet. So that's where it will be, I hope, in the next week or so, if people are interested in buying it.
All right. Well, we will have a link to your website and any other information that we can supply, because I think a lot of listeners will be interested in checking this out. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?